Good morning, and welcome to the Night Lodge of Theosophists here in Philadelphia. We conduct two weekly meetings, of course this one on Sunday mornings, where we take up a theosophical subject. During this month of October, we have taken up the idea of theosophy and the theosophical movement. And today we're going to be ending that month-long study with a talk about two great theosophists, Monius Sacchus and Tsongkhapa. Now, next month, November 6th, we begin our study for the month on reincarnation and karma. And on Wednesday evenings, we are studying the Ocean of Theosophy, a synthesis, if we can use that word, of the secret doctrine. It's a compilation of articles written by William Q. Judge during the 1800s that explain the main ideas that are found in the secret doctrine. And we are taking up universal principles, and all are invited to both of those meetings on Sundays and Wednesdays. The Sunday class begins at 11 a.m. on Sunday mornings and ends at 12. And prior to that, there's no library on Sundays. The doors just open a half hour before the meeting begins. And then on Wednesday, those meetings begin at 7:45. And prior to that meeting, from 5:30 to 7:30, there is a library that's available for your perusal, for your references, and just for general study. There's always someone at hand to point you in the right direction. And that's all the general information that's going on. We would like to again invite everyone to these free, open, public meetings. Now, because they are free, open, and public, in the spirit of theosophy, all meetings are conducted by voluntary contributions, but be it time, be it service, be it money. But it is a giving from within outward. There is nothing imposed or implied, but just the opportunity is presented for all to participate. Now, to do this, to keep these ideas before the public and more or less untarnished by personal opinion and the general ideas of the day, we have a declaration. And that declaration is that the policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification and practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for the union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophist all those who are it regards as theosophist all who are engaged in the true service of humanity, without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who wish to fit themselves, by study and otherwise, to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. We so declare. That in keeping with this, our class today is sort of a culmination of our month-long study of the theosophical movement and theosophy. One of the ideas or the purposes of the theosophical movement is the application of these ideas. And there's no better application than our own lives. And we are always looking and pointing to those who have come before us and led a theosophical life. And this morning we are going to talk about two of those that were shining lights onto the world. We have Ammonius Saccas, or Ammonius the Sack Carrier. He was born in the middle of the second century in Alexandria, the melting pot of ideas and cultures. Parents were very poor, so he was obliged to work and help support the family. So this is where he went on unloaded ships of and unloaded sacks of corn in the Egyptian section of Alexandria. There he heard many different dialects, languages, and ideas. The song of Krishna were on the lips of many sailors that came from Hindustan, from India. The ideas that he heard were from his Christian background. His parents were both Christians, and he was taught about the Christian Christ. But early on those docks of Alexandria, he heard the story of Krishna, how he was crucified, how he was hunted by an evil king, and how he was immaculately conceived. So at a very early age, even though he had heard the teachings of the Christian Christ, he knew that perhaps there were other legends found throughout the world that taught these same ideas. The atmosphere of Alexandria at this time was quite unique. Servius was the emperor of Rome. He embraced this ancient wisdom religion. But what was happening was there was a great age of tolerance. So everyone was able to do as they pleased. And most of the schools that now existed taught only but a portion of the great mysteries. But there was no unity. There's no basis for all of their thought. So Ammonius founded his mission or his responsibility to try and unite all of these ideas into its root. So the ideas that were prevalent were all based on ancient ideas. So the task was not difficult, but there had to be a basis of unity, and that was the basis for all of it. That there was one unknowable, unknown principle from which all came forth. It was universal. And this idea was the basis of the foundation for this unity. Now, he attended all of the schools that were found in Alexandria at the time. And he synthesized all of them. And he often wrote, not really, but it was written that he said that he would hear these ancient teachings and through visions and dreams of the night, they would be revealed to him what their true meaning was. So throughout the history of mankind, in Egypt, they had their hierophants. In Aryavarta, they had their rishis. In Greece, they had their didacti. Well, Ammonius Saccas was a theodidacta. He was God-taught. He was enlightened. Now, if when you begin to look, that because of this age of tolerance, there are other great souls that were on the scene, that we need to just remember in the sense that when we come across them, we know that their teachings are of unity. Valentinus tried to bring all these religions together or all these schools together in a sense of unity, but he failed. But he was around that same time. Bastilides. But all these, there was a whole movement where these ideas were prevalent in the society at that time. And the Christians became extremely jealous of these teachings. And they opened their own school. Origen, Clement of Alexandria were all directors of this school, but who later became pupils of Ammonius. So what Ammonius taught was no different than what Plato and Pythagoras were able to find out and know and understand. And where did they gain this knowledge from? What was the stream of this knowledge? Well, this is from Orpheus. The great mysteries of Orpheus. Well, who was Orpheus? Well, it was said that he came from the East, from India, and went throughout the world imparting these mysteries. Well, if we want to know the Orphic mystery or the teachings of Orpheus, read the Bhagavad Gita. These are the teachings of Orpheus. So this just became a line of influence, a line of truth, part of that Purim Para chain, that great theosophical movement. So what Ammonius did was, in his school, he taught, or they studied, not that he taught, but they studied all philosophies and all religions. The Vedantic, the Zoroastrian, the Buddhistic, Greek philosophies, the teachings of Plato and Pythagoras, Confucius. And this school became known as the eclectic school of theosophy. And one of the tools which were used to understand these other teachings, these other religions, was the rule of correspondence and analogy. Through this exercise, one were able to understand these universal ideas in response or in respect to the evolution of the soul or the experiences of the soul. So the basis of Ammonius' study was to form a nucleus of universal brotherhood and to show that man is but an emanation from that one source. And of theurgy, of making these ideas a living power in our life. Those were his purposes, not unlike HPB and the modern theosophical movement, but a continuation of those very, very ideas. Now, we have Ammonius, we have Plato, we have Pythagoras, but the students of Ammonius were Plotinus, Porphyry, Jamblichus, Proclus. Four names, Neoplatonist, that embody these ancient or this ancient wisdom. Because it's stated that none of the teachers or none of the great teachers ever wrote anything down. Ammonius being an example of that, but Confucius, Pythagoras, Plato, never wrote anything down. What we know of Ammonius comes from Plotinus. And the Aeneids, there is a volumes of work which were simply commentaries on the writings or the ideas of Ammonius and of this ancient wisdom religion.
What Ammonius did in Egypt, Tsongkhapa did in Tibet in the 14th century, but he had a different set of problems to deal with. Before his birth in 1357 in Tibet, his parents both experienced unusual dreams. His mother saw a huge mountainous-sized statue of Avalokiteshvara, and it diminished in size and then entered through the crown of her head. His father had a dream that showed Vajrapani, who entered his wife as a thunderbolt scepter. And there were many other precursors about Tsongkhapa. In time, he would come to be recognized as the boy that the Buddha had told Ananda would be reborn in Tibet and called the Glory of Wisdom. So the Buddha had predicted this birth. At the age of 3, Tsongkhapa took the layman's vows. At 7, he received the vows of a novice. At 16, he traveled to the great cathedral in Lhasa to take the bodhisattva vow. He then set out to master all of the teachings. He went to each of the various lineages and studied under the best teachers. He went to individuals who were known to be experts on a particular treatise and studied with them. At 17, he had become a proficient doctor of medicine, and by 19 was renowned as a scholar. He was the undisputed master of all the lineages in Tibet. And taking the Mahayana position, he began teaching Buddhist doctrine. But in Tibet, because of the laxity in discipline in the various monasteries and the divergence of various practices, there was a gap between theory and practice, and it was up to Tsongkhapa to purify it. Equally, the administration of the various monasteries was very much involved in politics and in money gathering, and he had to purify them of that as well. So he took the Buddhist thought and rid it of the superstitious and power-seeking tendencies. The Bon Society, which had long been part of Tibet, had joined with some of the Buddhist thinkers and created a very difficult situation. Their practices, the Bon practices, had come into Buddhist teachings. He, after this purification, established a school, the Gelupka school, the yellow hats, those that would stick to the pure and original Buddhist teachings, not mixed up with any of these other ideas. But his mission did not end with just that formation, which would have been enough. But if it had been all he accomplished, we wouldn't be sitting here today talking about this. We wouldn't know who Ammonius Saccas was or Plotinus, although some of us might be very well read in mythology and various spiritual thinkers. But without the Theosophical movement, we wouldn't have these ideas at our fingertips. Tsongkhapa summoned all of the adepts from all over the world to Tibet, and they worked together and created a system of laws and rules whereby they would not admit anyone into the secret school who didn't declare that their object was to help and teach others, and that they would begin the time of bringing these truths to the West, which, if we read any history about what was going on in the West, we know that on the one hand you had dogmatic religion controlling people by fear and threat and inquisition, and on the other hand you had the students of alchemy and various practices who had distorted and demeaned them, who were using them to make money or personal acclaim. So it was decided that an effort would be made to bring the true teachings to the West. And knowing cycles as they did, the realization that there was only, we can't think of the word. If you want to set up a cycle, if you make a cycle that is too broad, you allow an equal and opposite cycle that much opportunity. So it was decided that the last 25 years of each century would be the focus of this spiritual movement throughout the West. So if we look from the 14th century onward, we see a new spirit. We see revealed individuals working under the auspices of the Trans-Himalayan adepts. In 1409, Tsongkhapa realized an expression of his reform by inaugurating what was called the Great Prayer Festival at Lhasa, in which the first event, 8,000 monks participated. This 21-day event, which draws all the various orders together, does continue to this day in Lhasa under the auspices, in Dharmasala, because they can't be in Lhasa, under the auspices of the Dalai Lama. The third successor to Tsongkhapa became the first Dalai Lama. The present Dalai Lama is the 14th incarnation in this unbroken succession. But, and we may wish to go to the glossary and study this for ourselves, the Panchen Rinpoche, the great ocean or teacher of wisdom, is the title of the Teshu Lama, which means to say he is an avatar of Tsongkhapa. In law, the Teshu Lama is second to the Dalai Lama, but in fact, it is the Teshu Lama who is considered the esoteric teacher, and the Dalai Lama is considered the jewel of wisdom, the jewel of majesty. So there is a lineage of teachers that relates back to Tsongkhapa. But who was Tsongkhapa? We are taught that that he was an incarnation of Gautama the Buddha, who also returned immediately after his own experience as Gautama the Buddha as Sankaracharya because of the distortion of teachings. Well, by the 14th century, when Tsongkhapa incarnated, they were even more distorted. So Tsongkhapa is a great adept, an incarnation of the Buddha, the one who provided us with this opportunity to study these ideas. Now, we're sure you have questions. You want to be the one who calls? It gets confusing otherwise. Okay.
It was mentioned that, I believe it was the age of seven, that Tsongkhapa took the Bodhisattva.
No, at the age of seven, he got the vows of a novice.
Oh.
It was 16.
16?
Yes.
Okay. Is that the same, or is it just similar to the Kuan Yin pledge?
It is the same. It is the same, that one will not seek salvation for oneself, but seek to serve life. It is the same.
So if we take that pledge to our higher self,
yes,
we're taking the Bodhisattva vow, correct?
Actually, if we're students of the Voice of the Silence and we believe in it, we are on the Bodhisattva path. That's the whole purpose, is to awaken within humans that desire to be part of that path. Yes.
Well, it's interesting, though, that before he could do that, he had to take two previous vows, one of a lay person and one of the novice.
Mm-hmm.
So it does suggest we can't jump right to, even though our heart may be in it, we can't jump right to that Kuan Yin pledge. There's a lot of very difficult preliminary work that has to be accomplished. Could you speak to that?
Mm-hmm.
Well, being students of Theosophy, we know things do not move quickly, that the universe is evolving from within outward. By gradual steps, we move forward. So part of the paralysis of this age is everyone is in a hurry. And everything is quick now and immediate. Not that it wasn't that way in past times, but it seems to be more prevalent now. So it has paralyzed the natures of man. Man finds it more and more difficult to reflect back to that eternal, unchanging aspect of themselves and learn that virtues are not ideas unless they're practiced. And patience is one of the greatest of virtues. So if we are looking for anything, we present a roadblock to ourselves.
We think, however, if one is rash enough to feel the beauty of and be inspired by the Kuan Yin pledge and is then rash enough as they stand at that moment to take it within themselves, it will have a beneficent difficulty. They will discover things that are the obstacles, as was just mentioned. And they might not have discovered them for a very long time if they had put it off. So it is really a very individual thing. None of us knows, did we sit at the feet of Ammonius Saccas? Did we sit at the feet of Tsongkhapa? Where have we been in the past? So sometimes taking a pledge of some sort will stir up good things that bring bad things.
So it's really the gift of life.
Mm-hmm.
It's called resistance. Without resistance, we do not push. We do not look. We do not try to find the relief from that resistance.
So we really love the paradox of the paralyzing of moving too fast. Yes?
You mentioned the voice of the silence, and anyone who has In studying it, it explains those obstacles. That whenever you think you've reached a a higher point, there are the snakes and...
Yes. However, at the same time, you wouldn't have seen the snakes if you hadn't reached the higher point.
That's right.
So the obstacles that reveal themselves to us are like bonuses. We could not have them if we hadn't earned them. So instead of being cast down by them and calculating how wrong we are, we should be, in a way, rejoicing. Here is something I can now fix.
Yes. You know, the voice of the silence is a metaphysical rendition of the path. The Bhagavad Gita is as well, but it is a practical application of the teachings of Orpheus. And if we are lost, if we are ever lost, go back to the Gita, go back to the voice of the silence, and find your place on the path again, just through resistance and effort.
In the back.
It was mentioned the paralysis of moving too fast. A Parkinson's patient would agree with you, because tremor, taken to its extreme, is rigidity. And it reminds us that everything in nature moves in slow, gradual expansion, that when we are moving too fast, we've probably missed the point. So it's a reminder to go back, review what we think we know. If resistance comes up again, we can be sure we haven't learned it yet, so we need to do it in slow.
But we think we also should warn ourselves. We cannot use that as an excuse for not moving, for not making an effort, for being lazy. We have to find that wonderful midpoint between moving too fast and moving not at all. Yes.
We were thinking that preliminary work would be first working with the community, our family, mm-hmm. our friends, our immediate circle, ourselves, before taking on the wider duty of responsibility mm-hmm. of working for humanity at large. Mm-hmm. So we may miss the boat by moving too fast mm-hmm. or by jumping too high.
Well, that was exactly the original question. You know, there are steps along the way, and that we just need to be patient. And we are presented with the initiations when we need them.
Well, it's funny, though, because as students of theosophy, we talk about high ideals, and we hold them up to each other and to ourselves. But we have to deal with the immediate. If your ideal is to serve all of life and you can't get along with your next door neighbor or you can't get along with a family member, you're not going to serve all of life. You have to first fix that in you that is the problem. It always appears to us that the problem is the other, but the problem is our response to the other. And we all have a lot of growing to do. So we keep the ideal, but we work on the now. Yes.
Well, isn't it sad that it's greater to conquer one's own self than to conquer worlds?
Yes, the Buddha said that. Yes, and any one of us knows it when we try to change a habit of any kind. It's like moving a universe. It really is.
Well, but the teachings of Ammonius tells us that we are the universe. We are the universe. So what we consume as a universe reflects all of life. You know, in the simplest ways, what we consume in our mind, what we consume in our body, and what we consume in that subtle body. That's, you know, that we interact with all of life. You know, how can we know that the lower kingdoms are alive, like the mineral kingdom and the plant kingdom and the animal kingdom? How do we know that they're alive? Well, we communicate with them, but we don't do it through this, but we do it through our mind and that subtle body, because they are the same. They have a subtle body. They have that feeling nature which we can communicate with through our own heart and mind. By purifying our mind, we purify our heart as well.
Mr. Judge's wonderful statement, it's a contest of smiles, if we only knew. Yes.
It was stated that the mission, one of the missions of Tsongkhapa was to bring these ideas to the West. But didn't Ammonius do that? In the work he did in that Greek city of Alexandria, how did it become necessary to introduce it to the West if it had already been there or introduced by Ammonius?
Go ahead.
Well, if you see life is not a straight line. We have morning, afternoon, evening, and night, and there's a transition through all of this, so that the teachings are not always disclosed publicly. There are periods of night and of day. And what was happening during the time of Ammonius is that the mysteries had been there for a long time, but the cycle was coming to a close. You know, they said that Jesus came on the scene to keep these teachings alive and to restate them again. Well, Ammonius as well. But there were many teachers after him, but before him, Pythagoras and Plato. And if we know Western history, that the church became the darkness for the age, and that all of these ideas were suppressed. In the article, What is Theosophy? During a 25-year period, 90,000 people were burned at the stake for having these heretical ideas. And in London or in England, during a 3-year period, there were 3,000 people that were burnt at the stake. So there was a repression of these ideas, a darkness, because there was a subversion of these truths, that they were used for material purposes, and we know that these are the inherent right of all humanity, these ideas. And so therefore, it needed an impulse again to come before the public, or a public expression of that, and Tsongkhapa became that force.
Well, there's like 12 or 13 centuries between the two, and we see how things happened that were very difficult for ordinary people. If you were a noble, you could pretend to anything. You had power and position. The ordinary people were under the threat of fire or excommunication, various procedures used against them. They could also buy their way into certain allowances. If we stop historically and say, oh, okay, in 1375, Tsongkhapa and the adepts began this 25 years of the last 100 years of each century. What has happened since then? Did the theosophical ideas stay pure and one line of thought and teaching? Or were there adaptations and uses of it? You can go online and discover how theosophy will help you control the will of another. Amazing. How theosophy will allow you to make predictions and control the stock market. And you can find theosophy used as an instrument for any negative, selfish, ugly thing you can imagine. So ideas do not stay pure just because they are pure. They can be abused and misused. And that's the purpose of ULT, to restore the efforts of Ammonius Saccas and Tsongkhapa, to let people decide for themselves. Nothing comes between their teachings and the one receiving it. It is purely given. No opinion, no proselytizing.
One of the objects of Ammonius was to present the idea of theurgy, where the divine powers of man are used to control the blind forces of nature. So we see the expression of that all throughout the Middle Ages of the alchemist. But it was the outward expression of the inner meaning. But the ideas, the Kabbalistic ideas, or ideas of Chaldea, became also widespread. But Plato but Aristotle and so forth, the ideas that have always been there, but never popularized or never brought to the forefront.
Yes.
Well, it would be a good idea to sometimes.
You'll have to speak up for me.
Good idea sometimes to check the political and situation during those particular times of Muniasakis, which mentioned already, but during the time of Jhonkapa, and thereafter, and the relationship of the British East India Company in India, the battle between the Portuguese, the Spanish, and the British.
You want a lot from us.
Well, there's a lot of stories and all literature out there for the public.
Yes, that's true.
And after attending and hearing what we've heard about Jhonkapa and Muniasakis, do your own expedition. You may see those names crop up in your study of the British East India Company.
Well, the masters saluted the British for their treatment of India. If it had been some other country that went in to colonize a country, they would have destroyed so much of what was there. And the British did not. They may have looked down on some things, but they didn't set out to ruin it. Yes.
But there's an irony here. They had to have been influenced in that direction because their track record was to destroy and to pillage and to subjugate and to put peoples such as the Irish into a position of worse than slavery.
Where but look food, at us now, right?
Where the food that they had enough food to grow for themselves, but under pain of death, they had to export it.
Right. But the fact is that we have no idea, unless it's been revealed to us, the influences that were and are and have been at work on the various leaders of various countries. It would make sense, wouldn't it, that these adepts with their powers would know when to plant a seed or when to throw a little sunlight or water on something that was brewing in one leader's mind or heart and therefore see its way to a better result. It is said that it was the adepts that fostered the United States of America and particularly through the mind and heart of Thomas Paine. And even Thomas Jefferson responded to Paine in a letter saying, "You wrote the Declaration. You created the United States." Yes.
Well, just to add to that, you know, we always want to look at that lineage of last 25 years of each century. We go back to 1700, and as said, we see that in 1800, you know, this country was in the ravages of a civil war in the 1860s, and slavery was still a stronghold of suppression, and in the last 25 years that all changed, and this movement again came onto the scene. And the 1900s, we know we've lived through the 70s and the 80s of the 19th century. We know how the mind is beginning to open. And things are no longer can be kept secret, even as much as they try.
That's right.
But the lines of communication are wide open. So for any discerning mind to see the truth. So 1600s and the 1500s are still ones which we haven't answered yet. But if you,
well, we have something.
Yes, you have some? Great.
Something, yeah, but too many pages. How did I lose that?
How did we lose anything? Time.
Jacob Boehme and Robert Flood in the 1500s.
Giordano
and
Bruno.
Pardon?
Giordano Bruno.
Yes. And Giordano Bruno was actually the 1400s, along with the Rosicrucians.
No, he was put to death in the year 1600.
Well, I have him living as a very long time. Although, that is not unusual for the adepts. And can we see now why we are important? Not as individuals, but as what? Companions. The adepts cannot be here. We can barely be here in the midst of all this pollution. They cannot be here and be physically present with us. Their ideas have to be present with us, and that's our task as companions, to, as was said in the Declaration, to become an example of those very teachings so that it's spread inwardly as well as outwardly. Yes?
Yes, and one of her last wishes was that we keep the...
I can't hear you.
Okay. One of her last wishes was to keep the torch that she lit. And the fascinating thing about it, that back in the 70s and 80s of the last century, highly educated men were attracted. But that doesn't mean that men and women like ourselves cannot participate now in keeping the teachings before the public. It's amazing. It makes you feel humble.
Mm-hmm. You don't have to be highly educated to be a student of theosophy. It comes first from the heart and then from the mind. A child doesn't even have the words, and yet a child will live up to theosophical principles. Have you ever seen a two-year-old being handed three cookies when he's got four friends? He will give the cookies to the others and not take one for himself. I mean, not having the words to understand or to express it, a child often acts on that basis. So we don't need a high intellect. We need energy and enthusiasm and love. Yes?
It's interesting that we call these people great theosophists, but they never use even the term theosophy, not necessarily, or call themselves great. Why would we call them great theosophists? What would give us that privilege to declare somebody a great theosophist who themselves did not claim?
Well, no adept would ever take on the mantle of greatness, because any adept would know there is always that much more above and beyond. Therefore, the most perfected being knows that there is an entire universe of possibilities left. But what is theosophy? Theosophy is the original wisdom religion that was transmitted to humanity at the very beginning of the incarnation of the thinkers. And it is that divine wisdom that we say they are great exponents of the original divine wisdom. And they would know the word theosophy because of its derivation. They lived that word.
Ammonius was considered God-taught when he was on this plane of existence. And why? Well, in Alexandria, in the schools, the Alexandrian theosophists, there were neophytes, there were initiates, and there were masters. So perfectibility was known and understood. And Ammonius was thought so pure and so divine, you know, he said that one must cleanse oneself through self-contemplation, perfect chastity, and purity of body. We can approach nearer to it. Now, these to us seem like, whoa, You know, perfect chastity? Well, chastity is of mind, of thought, of deed. You know, and the cry of every thought theosophist, everyone is try, try, try. We don't, doesn't it, we are not perfect. We all have our imperfections. The only thing we can do is keep on trying and leave the results to the law. Not look for the results of our work, our actions. Just keep on trying. And how do we try? The Gita, the voice of the silence, quietly, you know, and it's like one is laboring alone in the darkness because no one's going to say, good job.
Thank you.
Good job. Nice idea. No, maybe here, mm-hmm. but not out there. You're going to be not treated as, you'll be treated as an outcast.
We would add, while the personal nature that we're working in and through is full of imperfections, if we turn to the Gita, we are perfect in potential. We have the potency of Krishna, of Orpheus, of Ammonius, of Tsongkhapa. We are that. And when we don't realize it, then of course we're dwelling in the imperfect. And we don't need anybody else to tell us we know.
Well, we like the sound of we are Orphites. We are students of Orpheus. And that would really be bring a lot of questions to people's minds.
I guess
it would.
You had your hand up for a while.
Well, it's recognition of the ideal, we think, relative to where we see ourselves. A hero would probably not call himself such, but an ordinary man running into a burning building to save a child, to us as a hero, he'd say, no, I just am doing my job, or I heard a cry. So the title is the title is the recognition for us, we think, of the ideal that life has reached. Mm-hmm. And it is, as I said, the motivating force for us to get busy. It's a model for us to relate ourselves to.
And we, well, to no. add, that hero, that word hero, is everyone looks for a hero. As a child, we're always looking for someone to emulate. Well, here we are. It took us a while, but we have Ammonius Saccas now. We have Tsongkhapa, all right? But these are our heroes as theosophists, those that show us that ideal that we can also achieve.
And we don't want to leave out HPB and what is nearer to us, Mr. Judge. We've always thought of HPB as the sun. You can't look directly at the sun and you can't get that close, but Mr. Judge is like a fireplace. You can be very comfortable. You had your hand.
We hear so much about great theosophists. We are wondering if there are individuals who work behind the scenes, mm-hmm. who are unknown, who may be doing great work that the world doesn't know about.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we know that to be true. We know that, but, you know, as said in the 1700s, what's his name?
Well, in the 17th, Cagliostro, Mesmer.
Well, no, the
16, Swedenborg?
No, the one who... Thomas Paine.
Oh,
Thomas
that
Paine,
one.
That
Sorry.
One. Well, you know, who was he? Look at a poor pot, you know, he was... Bankruptcy.
A corset maker.
Uh-huh. You know, where did these ideas come from? But, you know, by putting ourselves in sympathy with this great cause, through dreams and visions of the night, one is instructed.
And one of the things that we should be trying to do through our study is to increase our vocabulary, increase our understanding of universal principles, because those in the background who were sincerely making that effort, sooner or later were touched with a duty. Thomas Paine was touched through visions inside himself. He had no choice but to go ahead and to put them down and to inspire an entire nation of people to give up everything. We often think about the fact that we don't realize what those individuals who were dealing with creating the Declaration of Independence were laying on the line. Their lives, their families, their homes, everything. So we have to make the effort to be ready in case we are ever tapped on the shoulder to do some sort of duty.
And to do that, one must be impersonal. Mm-hmm. One must take a universal approach to what is happening. Plotinus, the student of Ammonius, they said was so impersonal, would not let them draw a portrait of his very being. For who needs to reflect on that? Yes?
Just to follow up that, we usually, when we think of a hero or make someone a hero, are great, we're referring to the personality. But could it be that the real hero is the same hero in each one of us?
Yes.
The real inner man struggling to break through the personality.
And those that deny the accolade of hero have themselves said, but it wasn't me. I just acted. I didn't think about it. I wasn't being me doing something heroic. It's from that inner welling up. We wanted to just say this about Tsongkhapa. At 62, he gathered his chief disciples together, gave his last instructions, passed into high meditative states, and ceased to breathe. He seemed to have spent his whole life writing, so numerous were his treatises, but it also seemed that he devoted himself exclusively to meditation, so constant was his practice. Yet he spent his life in almost ceaseless discourse to monks and disciples. He had done the work of three exceptional men at one time, even if you leave out all the normal activities. So the possibilities for us with what we can do, we may not be at that level. We don't have to act like three. We can just start acting like one. Be a hero to ourselves. If you're ever looking in the glossary, you won't find Tsongkhapa under T. He's under S. So, just a warning.
And Orpheus stated that our true hero is that higher self, because he states over and over again that we are but an emanation of that absolute man. So the idea of hero is always alive in the consciousness of man, or subconscious of man. But everything that we see has its hero. Mm-hmm. And we are drawn to that. But we know that our true hero is nothing but our higher nature.
Yes?
With the platform and the movement as it is, being compassionate, again, in the way there were in the past, but they're still witnesses, there's still a potential for it.
Mr. Judge said that it was HPV herself who would be coming back. Well, we shouldn't say herself, we should say the soul that incarnated in what we know as HPV would return to continue the work. There are always great souls at work, if not in the physical, at all times on inner planes. They would never desert humanity. The very thought that there is a chain of teachers of wisdom that seeks to protect and help, even if only one of us seeks their wisdom. But there's more than one of us. There's souls all over the world beginning to wake up and starving for truth. And the The most that we can do is keep it as pure as we can to pass it on. Do you want to conclude?
Well, we know that these great teachers do not come alone. They come with others to help and continue these ideas. So in that vein, we as theosophists wish to keep these ideas alive and open to the world. So again, in keeping with this idea that all activities here at this lodge are done through voluntary contributions of time, service, and money. And all are welcome to participate. Meeting adjourned.